Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The term filibuster comes from a French word for a pirate who would pillage the Spanish colonies in the West Indies. It also comes from a Spanish word of referring to American adventurers who incited revolution in Latin America. Today, it is referred to as procedural tactics to delay, kill, or force compromises of legislation. In general, the Senate filibuster is the right to unlimited debate. However, unlike the Senate filibuster, we try to place a limit on our discussion, but we also hope to reflect the world's greatest deliberative body and be a forum of civil debate and discussion of major issues from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. The topic of our podcast today is President Joe Biden's first 100 days. I'm Sean Evans, and I'm chair and professor of political science at Union and host of the podcast. I'm joined today by Hunter Baker, professor of political science and dean of the College of Arts and Science. Welcome to the podcast, Hunter.
Thank you very much. And you know, I have to note a couple of things. You mentioned the filibuster. I think we can safely say that the modern usage has overtaken its predecessors, that we are not using the word filibuster anymore to refer to piracy or anything of that nature. Fair? The other thing I want to say is, you know, so you mentioned that, and suddenly sort of a light bulb went off in my head. During this first 100 days, there's been a lot of talk about the filibuster,
yes.
Right? That it has again assumed center stage. Maybe you could explain to our listeners why there is this sudden kind of major interest in the filibuster.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, the importance of the filibuster is that to end it, you have to have cloture. And cloture requires 60 votes or 3/5 of the Senate to agree to that. The basic idea is this will encourage compromise between the two sides. The concern is in a more polarized political environment, the ability to get, in this instance, 10 Republicans to join Democrats to pass meaningful legislation is very difficult. Therefore, if the Democrats want to advance their agenda, then they're going to have to get rid of the filibuster for that to be successful. And due to the past 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency, the fact that he violated norms right and left, he claimed falsely that there was voter fraud that led to his defeat. With the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, Democrats are kind of thinking this is a make or break time, or at least some Democrats are thinking that way, in the sense that they believe that if they do not make these reforms now to democratize the country, that someone like Donald Trump could return and we could reverse a lot of the progress that we have made. And so that's why there is pressure on Senators Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and others to do away with the filibuster so that they can make these changes, legislative and institutional changes, so that democracy would survive and that someone who would be a threat to democracy, in their view, like Donald Trump, could never be elected.
Now, let's take further advantage of this moment. I feel like we have a golden educational moment
here. Oh, okay.
I think that for very many Americans, or Americans of a certain age, when we think about the filibuster, we have in our mind Jimmy Stewart,
yeah,
and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he's heroically holding the floor no matter how tired he becomes, no matter how disheveled he becomes, he continues to hold on and to kind of sort of lodge his protest against the powers that be. But that's not really the way the filibuster works, is it?
Not anymore. So that the Jimmy Stewart reference refers to what we refer to as a talking filibuster, where people will talk around the clock until they get tired or they can yield to a colleague who will then continue the filibuster. And so that's the historic idea of the filibuster. But basically, when you do something like that, you make it difficult for other things to occur. And so in the 1970s, they went to a tracking system to where the Senate would spend part of the time on one issue so that if you are filibustering it, then you could delay, kill, or force compromises, but they wouldn't spend too much time on it so they could go to other issues of concern and actually get things done. But by doing that, they actually lessened the cost of the filibuster and made it more likely that members would have a incentive to do that. And what we began to see were ideological censors were the first ones to use it, in which case they actually did get their opponents to compromise with them. It worked as designed. But once some started to do it and they saw the success, others started to do it. And then when we see since the 80s forward in the Senate, that Senate control could potentially flip every election or every other election, it creates incentives to obstruct to prevent the majority party from being successful so that you can run against a do-nothing Congress on some level, so that you would increase your chance of winning. And the more polarized we become, the more ideologues we have, the fewer moderates, there are more people willing to filibuster, which is why the Senate struggles to get much done.
So let's imagine that you are the Democrats, you're in power. We already have a government that is more difficult to operate than, say, a standard, parliamentary model like the British model or something like that. Why does either side tolerate the existence of these sorts of rules like the filibuster when they take power?
Well, that's a great question. It's something that political scientists have tried to study. And for a lot of times, these kind of rules stick around because, one, they're rules and they're hard to change. To officially change a Senate rule, it requires a two-thirds vote. That's why we've gone to the so-called nuclear option, to where they use a point of order to get around the Senate filibuster. For example, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid did this to prevent the Republicans filibustering appointments to the district and circuit courts into cabinet and sub-cabinet positions. And then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell extended that point of order change to Supreme Court justices in 2017. And so that's kind of why they do it. And to a large extent, both sides believe it's in their interest, because if they are flipping back and forth, they realize that they may be in the minority soon. And therefore, they want that tool at their disposal because they're afraid what a more polarized opposite party would do if they had power. That's why on some level you see many of the Democrats propose not just ending the filibuster, but to do that, to pass massive voting reform, to add D.C. as a state, to increase the number of Democratic senators and kind of reduce the Republican rule advantage in the Senate, potentially add Puerto Rico as a state in the hope that it would elect two more Democratic senators. At the same time, court packing and everything else to kind of remove those anti-majoritarian components of our system of government, which is the founder's design, even though the filibuster didn't exist. Though I would say I think the counter-majoritarian structure of our government is good in that it ensures that policy is passed not just on basis of raw power, but you have to use logic and evidence to appeal to more people. I think we have what the big change is the change in norms. It used to be if one party was elected, it was accepted that they had the right to govern. And so the filibuster would be used, but both sides realized compromise would be involved. The majority party say we have to give in. Minority realizes we have to give in at the same time. We don't have that norm in both parties for any kind of compromise to occur.
Sometimes even the Supreme Court gives in. As, for example, during the New Deal.
Yeah.
When the Supreme Court stopped opposing FDR, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you and so to a certain extent, you could see that some of the Democratic proposals to expand the court is really trying to work the rest or work the justices, in which case they're saying, remember what happened once, it could happen again. And the idea is, you need to be careful about the decisions that you make, or we might actually pull the trigger and expand the size of the court so that we get the results that we want.
Okay. Now, one more thing before I leave the filibuster behind that I have to explore, because I know you're a scholar of Congress, okay? So you've explained a lot of the reasons why we might maintain the filibuster and why the different parties might, you know, not want to go so far as to get rid of it. Is there any reason, maybe a self-interested reason, why individual senators would be reluctant to see the filibuster go?
Yeah. Look at the senators who are opposing this. It's moderates like Manchin and Sinema. And the simple fact is, they don't want to vote on some of this progressive legislation because they know it's going to be used against them in a campaign. So the whole point that they want to protect it is saying, hey, this stuff is never going to pass. Let's not bring it up in the first place. It's a way of protecting them. And then take someone like Joe Manchin. He's in a state that Trump won by over 20 points by saying, I'm not going to change this. That's a good way of messaging to the voters back in West Virginia that I'm standing with you. I'm going to stop the radicals in the Democratic Party. Same thing with Sinema. She's in the swing state of Arizona. She barely won in 2018. She's up in 2024. She realizes that if she's more moderate, she has a better chance of having a second term. If she has to govern or vote like a liberal, she's one and done.
Right. Yeah, especially if the Republicans have somebody attractive in 2024, right?
Yeah, as long as the Republicans don't self-destruct, which they're doing a pretty good job of so far.
Okay, moving on.
Well, you see, at one time I thought that we might actually have a podcast on the filibuster, but hey, we've covered a good part of it in the first 12 minutes.
I thought we needed to touch on that, especially since there's so much attention being paid to it lately. Okay, so we're continuing our discussion about the 100 days. What do you see as Joe Biden's major ambitions during the first 100 days?
Yeah, I think what we have seen is that Joe Biden had a narrow mandate, but he aspires to greatness. Remember that he won the Electoral College only by 45,000 votes or so in those close states of Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And so you would think he might be a little bit cautious, but he's not. He's trying to think, how can I transform government in terms of how can I be the next LBJ or the next FDR? In fact, he's talked to historians about that. So instead of being a transitional president, he's seeing this as an opportunity to be a transformational president. And so I think we can see this in a couple of things, because he's focusing on the environment, on social issues and governance. So he has these massive plans to combat climate change. And if you look at the people that he is appointing into the key environmental positions in the EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, and other places, these are people firmly committed to a major change in how to deal with the environment. And so they're going to try to use the next 4 years to change the way how the departments and agencies view climate change, so that it's going to be part of their decision-making going forward to whoever replaces them. It's going to be hard to change those processes. And look at what he's trying to do with the infrastructure build and trying to to modernize the electric grid, create a system of charging stations across the nation for electric vehicles, and also to tax credits for that. He's trying to do a lot of that. They're going to regulate carbon via executive order, to which even if that gets struck down by the courts, the fear of what's going on is going to force utilities and others to change the ways that they do business. So just like the clean air plan that President Obama proposal was killed by President Trump, utilities and others saw the directions things were going, and they're closing down their coal-fired utility plants and replacing them with things that burn cleaner energy. Also, in terms, he's focusing on the social issues. I mean, anti-poverty, racial injustice, expanding the safety net, dealing with immigration, very aggressive agenda. And then even with the idea of governance, he wants to be the anti-Reagan in terms of, it's not the fact to what Reagan said, government's the problem, not the solution. What Biden's trying to say is, look at what's going on in the pandemic. You realized how important government is. Government can work to make your life better, and here are the things that we need to do. And that it stands to what we talked about in terms of eliminating the filibuster, though President Biden has not endorsed that. Potentially expanding the Supreme Court. I don't think they'll go that direction. But also the big push for voting rights, redistricting reform, and campaign finance reform. And so if we look, we can see some big changes going on here. I mean, if he is successful, and that's a big if. It's the idea, are we moving from creating wealth to redistributing it? Because with a lot of these programs, we're taxing the wealthy, and we are providing tax credits, subsidies, and other things to poor. Some of these ideas are very good ideas, some not so good, which we may talk about. But it's also, are we changing from economic growth to sustainability? So it's not just let's grow the economy as fast as we can. Let's grow it at a sustainable rate to where we do not use up our resources at the same time. And then you can see in terms of regulation, a greater desire to protect. Instead of responding, let's be more forward-thinking and trying to prevent disruptions, whether with climate or other kinds of things. And so it's a very aggressive agenda. Some people say it's not quite as aggressive as people would say, because he's just really increasing money on things that Democrats already believe in. He's not really creating that many new entitlement programs like Social Security. He's really expanding the ACA. He's not really doing anything like Medicare for All, lowering the age for Medicare or something like that. But he is trying to increase spending by $4 trillion. That's after the $2 trillion in COVID relief over the next 8 years. And to keep that in mind, we spent about $4.3 trillion per year overall. So this $4 trillion divided by eight, we're kind of looking at an increase of almost 10% in government spending per year coming forward. And so that's very ambitious on his part. And I think he's able to do this for a couple of reasons. One, the Democratic Party is more homogenous and more progressive. Remember, Joe Manchin says, I'm a moderate, but he voted for all of the COVID relief, $2 trillion. He says, I'm all for infrastructure. We have to remember, he's a Democrat. He supports many of these ideas, and he's one of the moderates. I don't think he'll get all $4 trillion, but he's going to get probably three-fourths of that, and that's a rather, or more, and that's a rather significant expansion. And let's also not forget that Biden is blessed by disorganized opposition. I mean, think about what the Republicans have been doing the past few months. They've been aiming their fire at each other instead of the Democrats. And so I think that's helped to where the opposition is a little bit feckless here. And let's also not forget, people are just tired and worn out of Donald Trump, and they appreciate a sense of normalcy, at least in a president for a while. How long that will last and how long they're going to respond to these plans once they learn more about it, well, that's going to be the big question.
All right. Now, a few things I want to kind of pick out of that. Now, I've noticed you talked about, you know, relatively narrow mandate, but huge aspirations mm-hmm. to greatness, right? And I kind of wonder, you know, there has been this, I would say, a sort of a united message from, let's say, social elites, however you might want to characterize them. This build back better, right? You know, it's one of the big slogans, mm-hmm. build back better. So clearly, taking the view that COVID has provided us with some sort of pivot point in history or some kind of special opportunity, or the Great Reset, right? You know, both of these phrases I've heard many, many mm-hmm. times from sort of elite, call it the Davos crowd or whatever else. Why do you think there's so much cohesion of thought in this direction from folks at the top?
Well, because they're all homogenous. Yeah. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the research of Carsey and Lehman, I'm blanking on some of the other people, but some of the people who have looked at this and said, what we began to see in the 1970s is that the economic, political, and cultural elite began to merge in the sense to where a more educated, more liberal elite began to emerge out of the 1960s. And so those people in the 1960s are now in the positions of power in government, in economics, and in Hollywood, to where they are all singing from the same hymnal, so to speak. And so look at what you're seeing. I mean, this idea among the Democratic Party, you're not hearing that much say, okay, this is too much spend. It's like, okay, these are needed investments. You look at the mainstream media, they agree with these ideas because they're part of that too. You look at Hollywood, they have been promoting a social liberal message since the 1970s, and we have to remember these messages that they started in the 70s are finally kicking in. Remember, people who were born and lived before that time were socialized in a different way. These messages have an impact at the juncture of generations. So generations who have grown up since that time have been taught a different message. They have different views. And so we're seeing that come into play in politics in different ways. Or even look at commercials to today. Most commercials, if they show a family, it's a biracial family. They're trying to appeal to whites and minorities and everything else. Some of these things are very good things. But we have to remember that there's a homogeneity among our elites to where they are seeing the world, or at least they want to see the world that looks like them. And that's why you see this great reaction against the populist movement, because they're finding out the world doesn't quite look like them. And so just like many of the populists are afraid of the elites because they feel that they look down on them and they have different values than them, the elites are saying, okay, this isn't the country that we thought it was. We really need to bear down more to make sure that the country does look like us. And so COVID does provide this opportunity of look at what government did. They see Trump as a failed president. They see Trump and populism as a threat, so they are responding to that. In terms of the Great Reset, it's also the idea of this idea of a realignment. So we've heard the Democrats talk about the emerging Democratic majority since the 1990s. But if you look at certain demographic changes, you're beginning to see that that is becoming more true, even though we have not seen the votes fall the way that the Democrats had occurred. So I think we're seeing more incremental changes in that direction, and Democrats are hoping to hurry along those changes with some of the things that we've proposed, that they've proposed. Whether they'll be successful, I think, is a more complicated equation, and I'm not sure they're going to have the success that they think if they, even if they are able to pass many of the things that they have suggested. I know that's an awfully long answer.
Good answer. Very interesting. Now, there's another thing I wanted to, and so, you know, by the way, so I think that COVID is probably one of the things, but I also think that among that class you've identified, they feel much more urgency with regard to climate.
Yes.
Than regular folks, right? I mean, and so, you know, I think that's also emboldening them, driving them on some of these policies. Now, the other thing I picked up on, you talked about Joe Biden and an emphasis on voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so I have to ask, is voting rights a real issue? And the reason I ask you that is that you have this kind of Georgia law that to me was kind of a no big deal sort of a law. You may see it differently. But you have this kind of characterization as, you know, and Joe Biden may have even said Jim Crow 2.0 or Jim Crow on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of this rhetorical kind of battle over voting rights and what all this means?
Okay, I think there are a couple of things associated with this. So, first of all, I think part of the Democratic reaction is to what Donald Trump is referring to, the big lie, which is that he lost the election when, let's be honest, all the evidence suggests that he did lose the election.
Yes.
So it's the fact that they see Trump as a threat to the integrity of the election system, to where he has promoted conspiracy theories and he has promoted lies, to where I saw something today that 70% of Republicans believe that Joe Biden did not legitimately win the election. And so I think they're very concerned about that. The other thing I think we have to keep in mind is history. And in the Jim Crow era, what we did see is that the white planters, the white business people in the late 1800s did actively try to disenfranchise
sure.
blacks and poor whites.
Sure.
And that allowed them to perpetuate their power. And so I think when
Let me jump in right there. So, I mean, how many times have you and I and other readers seen headlines or story references during the 20th century that so-and-so was the first Republican or so-and-so was the first African-American elected to such-and-such a position since Reconstruction, right?
Yeah.
You know, implying a gigantic gap,
yes.
which, of course, was a gap created in part through these sort of measures to which you're referring.
Right. So I think we have to look at it from the perspective of an African-American in this perspective
yeah.
of they've been taught this history. They know this history. They've got grandparents or great-grandparents who have passed down. This is what happened in the past. And so when there are what are things referred to as restrictions or maybe voter suppression, then I think that's going to strike a chord with many African Americans. And I think many Republicans, I think, are blind to how some people are perceiving this. Now, I do think this is a overreaction to refer to this as Jim Crow. We do know from research that voter ID does not have an impact on turnout because it leads to a counter-mobilization effort. And with a lot of the things we see that they take something away, but then they give it in another instance. And part of what we also see is that we just had a pandemic where a lot of new voting things were put in by administrative fiat by some state officials, but also by some county officials. So what you saw in Fulton County, Georgia, and others were they created drop boxes and everything which were not authorized by state law, and they did it there while the Republicans were not doing it in other places, which gave them an advantage in getting out their vote. And so I think that part of the Republicans are saying is we're trying to even the field on this. But I think the other thing I would say is to where I don't think this is Jim Crow. I also think if you're a Republican, one, why are you trying to fight ways of trying to make it more difficult for people to vote? I think we can increase the ability for people to vote while also making sure that we can reduce fraud. And so in that regard, they're focusing more on the fraud, but not on the expansion. I think if they did both, they would be perceived by voters and others in a much different way.
Okay, makes sense. But now, look, if we're trying to be the unifying president after mean, nasty Donald Trump, does it make a lot of sense to be talking about Jim Crow 2.0 or Jim Crow on steroids?
Well, but here's part of what I would say. Look at what he has focused on. He's focused on the things where there is greater unity in the Democratic Party. Pandemic relief, anti-poverty measures, physical infrastructure, health care, education, environment, spending. He's referring to Jim Crow because of the voter laws in Georgia, Texas, and other places. That's not what his focus is. He's not paying attention to things which are more divisive, whether it's policing reform, voting reform, the filibuster expanding the courts, because he knows if he starts focusing on that, he's going to alienate the independents that he needs. And so I think that's actually a smart strategic choice on Biden to go big, to go bold, and to move quickly. Because what we have seen over the past 20 years is overreach and then backlash. They know they're going to lose the House at least in 2022. They talked the big game, oh, we've got popular programs, we may win. They know they're going to lose. They know they have a year to get things done before election concerns kick in for Democrats. So that's why they're trying to use reconciliation. They can get a majority vote to push things through, and they're trying to get it done quickly so that election concerns don't slow it down or reduce the size of it.
So this is basically the Obama experience all over again, right?
Yeah, if you talk to a lot or read a lot about what Joe Biden has learned from the Obama years, it's things like go big and bold. Remember, he reduced the size of President Obama reduced the size of his stimulus package to try to get Republican support. What they've also said, yes, we're willing to negotiate, but we're not going to wait forever. We're going to set deadlines. You have to be serious. So Joe Biden has told Senator Capito of West Virginia, the ranking member of Environment and Public Works, I'll negotiate with you, but we'll set a deadline, and you have to meet me halfway. If you stick with your proposal, we're not going to have a negotiation. And then when it comes to things like reconciliation, they've decided, why negotiate if we don't have to? If we can get all this done by majority vote, why should we weaken that? I also think that's why they're trying to frame things in positive ways. COVID relief. Who's against COVID relief? Nobody. But think about what they said after COVID relief passed. It was the greatest anti-poverty measure because about 25-30% were about COVID relief. The rest was about expanding subsidies to health care, the child tax credit to reduce poverty, and other things. It's what they're doing with the infrastructure bill. It's roads, it's bridges, it's sewer treatment plants, it's rural broadband, but it is building schools. It is about hiring healthcare workers. It is about all this other stuff because they're using infrastructure, because who opposes infrastructure? And if you look at polling, this stuff is polling well because people, when they hear infrastructure, they think roads and bridges. They're not thinking about everything else. And even thinking in terms of it's free money for most people. They're getting money and someone else is paying for it, whether it's corporations, those who make $400,000 or more. What's not to like about that when you get free stuff, and I put that in quotation marks, when someone else is going to pay for it? So, I mean, I think politically you can say that Joe Biden has done a very good job in trying to advance what he wants the first 100 days. He still has a whole lot of obstacles in front of him, but politically, in trying to get what he wants, short term at least, I think he's been very successful.
Well, now I wonder, with regard to COVID, which, you know, drove a lot of what the Trump administration was doing there at the end, and of course what Biden is doing already, do you think that the public policy has been responsible, right? So, for example, we talk about, there are some people who haven't received the payments, the mm-hmm. cash payments, but obviously have been very widely distributed, right? Whether you lost your job or not, whether your financial situation changed or not, was that wise? I mean, is that the kind of thing we should have done, or should we have been more disciplined and tried for something more targeted to people who were actually disrupted by COVID?
Yeah, I think that's the argument we're going to have in the future when we look at this retrospectively. I think with the pandemic, with the shutdown, many of the programs that they did were necessary, whether payments to everyone, the PPP program to help small businesses and others, to extend that lifeline to their employees. I think that made sense, especially when we were in the shutdown period. I think as we begin to open up, I think there is probably less of a reason to have the massive programs that we have. I think what we have seen is, for example, the stimulus checks. What we have found is poor people, it's been very useful to them. They need it for food, for rent, for basic necessities. But for more affluent people, what we have found is they're paying off debt or putting it in the bank. And if they're paying off debt, I think that's a good thing. But we have to remember, that's not stimulating the economy. That's putting people in a better financial situation, which, if it leads them to be a little bit more physically conservative in their own life, is good, because there are a lot of people who have large debt problems.
Yeah. You know, I have kind of wondered if there's not almost, we're developing sort of an unreality of the numbers, right? I mean, I remember when Obama, we were talking about, you know, something close to $1 trillion stimulus at the beginning, and it was just mind-boggling, right? You know, it's just...
Yeah.
And we're at the point where we can just casually kind of throw around $4 trillion.
Well, but look at what has gone on. What President Trump did was, when he was president, $4 to $5 trillion. So the idea is, it's become normal for some people to say, oh, $4 or $5 trillion. It's not that big of a deal. President Biden, with the COVID relief and his proposal, is proposing $6 trillion in spending. Wow. I mean, I wrote that number on the board with all of the zeros for my students in class last week to give them an idea. And I bring up, okay, you know, I understand why we spent this money. I understand why they're saying we want to spend this money now. But think about it. When are we going to pay this back?
Yeah.
How's this going to affect you in the long term? And I think we've seen this play out to where Republicans were not financially responsible the past 4 years. President Trump never cared for that kind of stuff. And now people are saying you have no credibility to talk about massive spending because we're doing what you did. And while I understand the logic of that, we still need to think long term. Deficits are a problem long term. I know when Lord Keynes was asked about, you know, spend more in depressions and tax when times are good. We never tax when times are good. So it said, what about debt in the long term? And his response was, in the long term, I'll be dead. Well, the problem is eventually that long term is going to be real for some people, and it's going to have an impact on their cost of living. And I'd be more comfortable with this spending if people said, here's how we're going to not just pay for it, but for all the other debt that we have added because of poor fiscal responsibility of both parties over the past 50 years. But that's too politically costly to say, I'm going to raise taxes and cut your benefits.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the... It's funny, this was Jack Kemp, who was always a we'll grow our way out of the trouble kind of guy. He used to call that root canal economics, right? You know?
Yeah. Well,
that nobody wants it.
And the simple fact is, we never grew ourselves out. I mean, you could point to the 1960s tax cut potentially did that, but the tax cut since has not grown us out of the deficit spending.
Right. Well, the truth is, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, people make fun of the Laffer curve. I actually think the Laffer curve is axiomatically true.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if that 39% high end isn't kind of a sweet spot on the Laffer curve, because we seem to do pretty well on revenue, you know, at that spot. It's a little different when you get to the corporate question, because international competitiveness and things like that. Another thing about the money, I kind of wonder about our capacity to actually deploy the funds. And I know we've been doing that, but my understanding is there's still an enormous amount of money sloshing around from the Trump administration, and we're already, you know, we already got to put this other huge package out. And I almost wondered, give it a little time.
You know,
policy lag. Let it work its way out a little bit more.
Well, if you listen to the Republicans, they're saying let's pay for the fiscal infrastructure bill by clawing back that money we have not spent.
Right.
To pay for this. But if you're the executive branch, you have this large slush fund that you can potentially use as you see fit. So it's very unlikely a president is going to give up the ability to give money to favored constituencies or states if it's going to help him politically.
Right. That's right. Okay. You know, now another thing that I'm kind of curious about with infrastructure, okay? Now, you talked about how the American people react very positively to infrastructure, and I think with good reason, right?
Yeah.
For example, I can't remember if I said this in the previous podcast, but I can think of few things that have paid larger dividends than, say, the Tennessee Valley Authority or the Eisenhower Interstate System. Or even if you look at a city like Huntsville, NASA, you know, I mean,
right.
a number of these things, the investment has paid for itself, you know, very well, very substantially. So Americans, I think, would be wise to view that positively. But the question is infrastructure really infrastructure? That's the question.
Right. And a good portion of it is. This gets to the Democrats are trying to change the nature of how people view infrastructure. While the American they're referring to the most recent proposal, the $2 trillion proposal, as the American Families Plan, they're also referring to it as social infrastructure. And so they understand infrastructure is a popular idea, so they want to throw everything they can under that idea so that people say, oh, this is infrastructure spending, we're going to be more supportive of it. So it's good politics, it's not good grammar, or maybe it's not good definitions.
So are Americans going to buy that? Is that are Americans? So, you know, we have had this drumbeat, I feel like, for at least a decade or more, that America infrastructure-wise is falling behind. That, you know, and in fact, infrastructure is a huge part of China's plan moving forward. obviously our greatest competitor. Are we, you know, are we taking that issue seriously enough? And if the Democrats do kind of perform this verbal sleight of hand to recharacterize infrastructure, is it going to work? And even if it works in the shorthand, are they going to be vulnerable to criticism for that later?
Okay, so I do believe infrastructure is important. I think when we look at infrastructure, we have to be careful about what we're talking about. So roads, bridges, everyone says, yeah, that's good. But if we look at it, federal roads are in good shape. It is state and county roads that are in trouble. So the idea,
but also things like airports, right?
Right. So the idea is many of this road stuff is to provide money to states to make repairs on things that they should have been doing in the first place. But yeah, so that you could say that's a good idea. Now, whether the Fed should pay for it is one thing, but airports, railroads, ports, these are all things to where we say, yeah, these can have an impact on the economy. I think rural broadband would be important. If we want to help industry be in more rural areas, if that's even possible these days, these are the kinds of things that are going to be important for that. I think when we're looking at whether this will help them, I think as long as it's infrastructure, it's fine. But the more people they find out about it, I think the more problems that they're going to have. And long term, I think when you twist the meaning of words too much, it's going to backfire on you in some way. It's kind of like Clinton saying it depends upon what the meaning of is. I mean, we kind of laugh about that. So are we going to be the same thing? The meaning, it depends what the meaning of infrastructure is in that regard. And eventually people will wise up to the word games that people are using. But as Rahm Emanuel said in 2008, never waste the opportunity to use a crisis to advance your.
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yes. That's it. That's how the Democrats are looking at this.
Now, okay. So one more thing, I feel like we have to touch on this. Is the situation of small business relative to the Biden administration? Okay, because I would argue, and I think small business, if we could have the the chamber here, you know, national or local, I think that they would say we're being hit on two sides by the Biden administration. One is they feel that all of the COVID relief and the payments are taking people out of the potential employment pool, right? A lot of people are unable to find staffing for their businesses. Second, the Biden administration is pushing pretty hard toward a $15 an hour minimum wage. So both of those things potentially have a fairly adverse impact on small business. What do you make of that?
Yeah, couple things. I'm not sure they can pass a minimum wage increase unless they get rid of the filibuster, but that does put pressure on them. I think you're right that some small businesses are having problems finding people to work because the people they would usually hire can make the same or more with the expanded unemployment benefits and others. But of course, I think the Democrats would respond with, well, then the problem is you need to pay people more. I think in terms of the impact of the minimum wage, the way I look at this is most places have a market wage and a minimum wage. So, for example, the minimum wage in Tennessee is $7.25. But if I talk to my students, the local businesses are paying them between $10 to $11 an hour. So if you raise the minimum wage up to $10 to $11, it's not going to have an impact because the businesses are already paying that.
Yes.
If you go above that, I think that's when you're going to see a potential impact. The other thing I would say about this is two other ways small businesses are concerned. One is they're also concerned about regulation. The thing that we tend to forget at times is that big business is sometimes the biggest supporter of regulation because they can bear the cost of regulations where small businesses can't. So they use it to make their competitors less competitive so that they maintain their market share, potentially expand it. But on the downside is they're not as innovative, may not be providing the best product at the best price. The other thing that many small businesses are concerned with is President Biden's tax plan, especially pass-through businesses. So these are the types of businesses, whether it's doctors or small business people, to where their salary comes from small business profits. And the idea is if they're being charged higher rates, then that's going to affect them because instead of being charged at a lower rate for what they take home, it's they're going to be charged that 39% on profits overall. And so I think you see at times this small business, big business concern. That's why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has fewer problems with a lot of things that President Biden is doing because they represent big business.
Yeah.
You talk to the Jackson-Madison County Chamber of Commerce, they're more concerned about small business, and I think you're going to see a lot more concerns about President Biden's tax, regulatory, and other policies.
Well, and you referenced something that I think everybody should pick up on, okay, which is that on the way up, right, Amazon is a classic case study. On the way up, they want laissez-faire. They want to be left alone by the government. Then they reach a certain degree of maturity, you know, a certain amount of wealth, and they're happy to pile on the regulations. Why? Because they can bear the weight of them, and their competitors can't, right? It's a good way of foreclosing or knocking down a lot of their competition, and we see that time and again. Certainly we have with the internet companies. Now, you know, one final thing I want to ask you about is the border.
Mm-hmm.
What is Joe Biden? So where is Joe Biden in the first 100 days on the border? Where is he going to go on the border?
That's a good question, and I think that's the question the Biden administration is asking themselves. So what we have seen is that President Biden ran saying that President Trump's border plans were wrong, we're going to do something about it. And they eliminated a lot of the administrative reforms that President Trump put into place to try to reduce that. So it's the combination of reducing those reforms, but also this idea that a President Biden would be more open to immigration that has led more people to come. Also, let's not forget that with the pandemic decreasing, people feel it's more safe to travel, which gives them incentives to come across the borders as possible. So I think they did not expect to see the numbers of people try to immigrate into the country that has. They were caught flat-footed, and that's why they were then putting more people into the immigration camps that they complained about that have even more capacity than they had under President Trump. You saw that's why they were not moving the refugee cap, which they're having all this pressure on, that we need to do that. I know that President Biden issued a whole lot of executive orders on immigration or executive actions when he became president. But the thing that most people don't realize is a lot of these executive actions were not what they thought it was. A lot of these were just studies. Let's study what we're going to do so that we'll know how to act. And people were expecting action. They're still studying because they don't know what to do. And if you look at public opinion polling, Biden scores well on just about everything, on COVID, climate, the economy, taxes. The two areas that he's underwater in polling is guns, not by much, which is kind of surprising, but the border by about 20 points. And so I think that's why you see Republicans focusing a lot on the border, because they see that as a weak spot. And even those people who were very concerned about Trump overreaching, they're looking at what President Biden is doing, and they're saying, folks, if these guys can't shoot straight on this, are they going to be able to shoot straight on others? And I'll throw this in. I think one of the biggest obstacles to President Biden going forward is implementation. Let's say he passes all this $4 trillion, about 70 new programs. Are they going to hire the people who can run it well, or are they going to hire people who are connected Democratic operatives and everything else? If you really want to change the way people perceive government, you're going to have to manage government well. And the way our civil service laws are written, we don't focus on efficiency, we focus on fairness. And that's one of the reasons why government does not always do things well.
That's right. And there's a lot of are we really trying to get a job done, or are we trying to create income opportunities for a legion of rent seekers, of whom there are legion, right?
Yes.
I mean, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think that we have covered the water pretty well during this, I guess, about an hour of the filibuster podcast.
Yeah, I'm seeing here we're at 56 minutes here, so I think that is close. Well, thank you for participating, for asking some questions. I hope I was not too expensive at times. But and, of course, we thank you, all our listeners, for listening to the filibuster podcast. And with that, I will yield back the balance of my time. Thank you for listening.